Squadron Leader Waglandry 1.
Please could you tell me when you joined the Air Force and how it came about, please?
I think following the crisis in Czechoslovakia, the Munich meeting in September 1938, a lot of us felt we ought to be prepared to for what might come about. So that a number of us were ready to join the Territorial Army or the naval people, in my case the RAF, VR. And so I applied to join. And in due course, early August, I was sworn in as an AC1, made an LAC cadet the next day, but I was still in the office and we were going to evening classes where we were taught map reading primarily at that stage. The idea is we were signed on for 5 years service, at the end of which our training would have been completed, including an odd flight here and there on a Hawker Hart or something of that kind. And then at the end of that period, if we qualified, we would be made sergeant navigator, or air observers, really. We were training as air observers, which was navigation, bomb aiming, and air gunnery. First of September 1939, we were called up. Considerable havoc everywhere. And we went to London town centre that we were allotted to, just checked briefly medically, was supplied with kit and so on, and then told to return home and stay on call. Subsequently, early November, right at the beginning, received a telegram to report to the centre again, and then we were dispatched by train up to Prestwick to the Scottish Aviation Navigation School. We were given, there was quite a bit of ground training, as it were, lectures. Our tutors were largely mariners, as it happens. The head of the course was a retired lieutenant commander, and the others were, how can I put it, civilian mariners who had border trade certificates. We were supposed to have only a brief period on Fokker Airlines. They had a 36 and a 22-seater airliners, just for air experience. And then we were to go on to Anson's. As it happened, we did rather more on the Fokkers, which were not easy aircraft, because one was simply looking out a window, just as you would today on the airliner. But having completed that course, we were sent to Derby, which was where there was the bombing and gunnery school. We had, of course, ground training on machine guns and bombs of various kinds. We did bombing practice with short-nosed Blenheims, and we did air gunnery on battles. The intriguing part with the battle was, or two parts really, that if you were using the bomb site, the Mark 9 bomb site, to get wind drift, for example, you had to open a slot in the floor, and you got all the heat from the single Merlin engine up front, which even used to melt your chinagraph pencil you were trying to write on top of the site with. And then for the air gunnery, of course, you had to fold the canopy back, and you had a monkey chain to hold you in case you disappeared over the site. And I always envied the courage of the pilots, because when you hold a machine gun against the slipstream, you hold it quite firmly, but as soon as you start firing, it goes out of your hands and starts going through the rudder post. And so the pilots used to blanch a bit, I think, when they saw what had happened when we got back. But anyway, that was the course for that. And then in June, some of us were selected for commissions, which came through whilst at Abingdon, the OTU. Number 10, I think it was, OTU. And we were dispatched to get our uniforms. And there was big pressure on following the fall of France. for example, the practice had been that when some of the trainees had been commissioned, they would be held back by a fortnight and go on to a later course, so they didn't go back to the same course with people who had not been commissioned. But that didn't happen with us. We went straight back to our original course. And there we flew on Anson's, and there's quite a bit, again, groundwork of plotting and so on in its instruction. We then went across to Jerby for doing bombing training on the Whitley aircraft, which was our operational aircraft. But we were called back from there because of this pressure was developing, and we were dispatched to squadrons. I went to, was sent to Linton to join 78 Squadron, only to find it had been moved, and I finished up at Dishforth with them. Also at Dishforth was 51 Squadron, and one met a number of fellow trainees in these squadrons. One chap, Alabaster, who had a very fine career in the Air Force, we seemed to meet one another quite a bit. He was in 51, I was in 78. And then we were doing bombing operations in the ordinary way, and I was on leave at the time when the aircraft we'd had and 51's aircraft had been converted for paratroop dropping through the floor. And whilst I was away, some of them went off to Malta, where they did the dropping paratroops on the Italian aqueducts to blow up the aqueducts there. I think the Navy brought them out. But anyway, these chaps came back, and so we still had these converted aircraft, but we were using them on bomber operations. And one night when we were due to fly on a bombing op, we were taken off and told to take our aircraft down to Stradishall. And that was where the flight which began the Thamesfield exercise was established. And so we were delivering our aircraft to this flight, nature of which we'd never heard of before. And we met one or two of our former comrades from Dishforth days down there. And they were saying how they were flying in low and this and that. We used to fly as high as we could get. And it all sounded rather unbelievable. And so I had a very early contact, and it so happened that the aircraft we had and which we delivered was the one which Hockey used for his drop in the Toulouse area later on. So these coincidences are rather extraordinary.
Can you say something about those bombing raids that you went on?
Well, yes, they were general, of course. When I first joined the squadron, I flew with various people, then largely with a flight lieutenant, Patterson, who was number two in our flight, which was B flight. Squadron leader Toland, a Canadian, was the commander of B flight, and Patterson was his number two. And I joined him. We flew together for quite a long time until he'd moved away.
What kind of targets were you operating against?
Well, mainly in Germany, we had some, like Bordeaux, when we bombed an oil refinery in the River Gironde, just up from Bordeaux. And then, I'm just looking through here, we did reconnoiter operations on the Channel ports because of the fear of invasion.
And this was in Whitley's?
This was in Whitley's, yes. Stettin, for example. Halle Railway.
It must have been extremely hazardous at that stage of the war.
Well, the in a sense, there weren't so many, but when you had these big masses of of the Pathfinders and supporting aircraft later in, I wouldn't have thought an AA could have missed anything, you know. But we worked individually, of course, and you sometimes saw your comrades over the target, the aircraft. The Germans were very efficient with the AA and searchlights, I must say. And they were very good with their camouflage and trying to... We didn't have pathfinders then, you see, with camouflage to try and throw you off course. Main attacks were on, like, oil refineries in Germany, where the synthetic production, and the railway communications. Hamburg was a native one because the Germans... this huge lake there, name which escapes for the moment, but they had a bridge across it and they filled up below the bridge on the water with dummy houses, wooden houses, and moved and made another bridge up just as dummy to throw you off. You see, if you were trying to get something like a post office in, which you couldn't see the building at night, of course, but you knew what point you were supposed to be aiming at, by reference to other things you could pinpoint. Well, then, if they could push you off a little bit, they were saving their communications. But the Whitley, quite a sturdy aircraft, slow, of course, but it was sort of 130 mph, more or less, whichever way you were going. And... in winter, they could carry 400 or 500s in the bomb bay and 650s in the wings. Then in summer, because the range was shorter, they'd put 500s in the bay and for the summer. And then in the winter, they'd replace those with petrol tanks for the long distance.
Did you have any narrow escapes on those?
Well, you used to, you know, it sounds a bit of a line shoot, but you used to count the holes when you came back from shrapnel which came off the AA shells, which were obviously pooping off around. And one of the problems there, of course, was when you were making a bombing run, you had to be steady and level, which pilots didn't enjoy over much, but any blast could put you off a bit, of course. But other than having, I've never hurt in any way. Simply, you find a bit of your chair knocked away, something like that. But that's the nearest squeak I ever had. Never had any wounds of any kind.
What about your brother aircrew in the squadron? Were any of those lost on the race?
Quite a number, yes. And this was an unpleasant situation. Sometimes you might have seen somebody go down, not knowing necessarily who they were, but you saw somebody being shot down. And of course another hazard too was coming back. The Germans had long range fighters, and whereas in Yorkshire we were going in and out at Flamborough Head, which was a pinpoint we used, they'd be waiting for you as you came back. But never had any trouble over that personally. But,
which do you think was the biggest hazard, the German anti-aircraft fire or their fighters?
I would say at that time the anti-aircraft fire. This was in 40 running into early 41.
What were the problems of navigating at that time?
Well, you didn't have much to work with. The only aid, there was no radar, of course. You relied on the wireless op to get an MF fix, which was done by two stations. He'd radio through to the control point, and two stations would take a line on you and obtain a fix. Usually, it depends where you were relative to how accurate it was. And then they'd radio that back to your wireless op, who would pass it on to you, all of which took quite a time, of course. But that was better than nothing if you couldn't see what was going on. Otherwise, you've very much dependent on pinpointing by map reading. And well, that worked generally. If it was very cloudy, of course, it was a bit grim. And we were given a primary target in our briefing with a target map, and also a secondary target if we couldn't identify the primary. And in those days, we weren't to bomb anything else unless we're very positive as to what it was. In Hamburg, for example, if you could see the docks. But on the other hand, you were not allowed to drop your bombs willy-nilly, and on the way back you jettisoned into the sea if you thought you were running out of, you know, petrol was a problem. And of course Holland was neutral, so you weren't allowed to fly over Holland.
What about the accuracy of the bombing? How accurate do you think that was?
Well, we all thought it was pretty good, but I think this is where they felt the Pathfinders were brought in to improve the accuracy for the number of bombers involved. And we used to have a camera on board, which as we bombed, the camera could take shots, you see. And all those arguments afterwards, you sort of say to a captain, his crew, well, this, you weren't the target, you were here, you see. And he said, no, well, that's not my photograph, was the answer to that one. But, because, again, it depended on the target. If you had, I remember Kiel bombing the docks there at port, and it was all ablaze everywhere, and so you could see everything extremely well. But as I say, in bad weather conditions, a target like a railway, important railway junction, there's probably nothing near it, like a lake or anything, or a river, that helps to show it up.
What was Dysforth like to operate from?
Well, it was a grass aerodrome in those days, not all that large, but quite satisfactory for Whitley operations. And in the winter, when it snowed, they used to have a huge sledge. They stacked snow on it to tow it up and down to make a rather icy, but nevertheless a flat runway.
You say that you did this kind of work from 40 to into 41. What happened to you then?
Well, that's when we'd already moved the squadron up to Middle St. George, which was a new station, and I understood to be the last of the permanent stations to be built. And I'd completed my tour of operations, and I was still on the squadron there as a pilot officer. And they established the post of station navigation officer. And so I was put in that rank as a flight lieutenant. Subsequently, we had, well, two things happened. One is that Crofts Bar was opened as a satellite aerodrome, and then 78 was moved to that, and 76 Squadron, which was the second of the Halifax Squadrons to be formed, was brought in. And then sometime after that, 76 was fitted with G, which was a very secret situation at that time. What I think handled my post there wasn't as enjoyable as it might have been, as it were, was that having the two stations, which was a new idea, and also being mess secretary, which was one tended to happen to station navigation officers at that time. So what with darting about and one thing and another, I felt I could have more time for the actual job concerned. But we used to, the group navigation officer, he would phone, we'd have, after an operation, we'd get hold of the navigator's logs and plotting charts, and plot out to try and judge the wind, the average wind that was applied to the target. We would then report our figures into the group nav officer, who would decide what wind should be applied to give us some idea of the accuracy of the thing. But but it didn't really, I don't think, compare with getting photographs of where people have been.
Where is Middleton, St. George?
It's near Darlington. It's right around. One of the hazards of that, and we lost a very able flight commander on a Halifax. It was a Middlesbrough plume barrage. And we lost one chap in there. And although we got these cutters on the wings, you've heard of these cutters for cutting cables. It's got a plume barrage with a cable. And if the wing hit it, then the cable slid down into a slot which had a shotgun cartridge in it, which fired a cutter to cut the cable.
Was it effective?
Sorry?
Was that effective?
I think so, in some cases anyway. And of course it was really meant to be to tackle the German balloons rather than our own. But
how long did you do that job as station navigator?
About a year.
So 41, 42?
That's right. Because March 42, I went down to Bob McMahon headquarters.
Can you tell me about the work that you did there?
Yes. I would mention, it was supposed to be a rather silly joke on my part, that Sir Arthur Harris went in February 1942, and I went in March 1942, but I think it had a greater influence on affairs than I ever did. But what we had was the air staff made up of various sections. There was the radar and radio and so on, and engineers then we had intelligence section, but we had the navigation section at that time comprised of a group captain, two squadron leaders and two flight lieutenants. There was a squadron leader, Nav 1A, squadron leader Nav 1 and a squadron leader Nav 2, and then the 1A and 2A were flight lieutenants, which was the lowest form of animal life in Bomber Command headquarters at that time. If in a mess a pilot officer came in, all the air officers used to stand and gawp, you know, rather H.M. Bateman type of situation. But that was very interesting in that we used to visit stations to see how things were going on and so on from these chaps, what their experiences were, and the station navigation officers. And it was just about the time I was leaving when DCT Bennett got back to this country and started up the Pathfinder Force, which of course made an extraordinary difference to the whole bombing operation.
Did you have any personal contact with Bennett?
I met him. I wouldn't say it was personal contact in the strict sense of the word.
What kind of a reputation did he have?
Oh, very high, because he was one of these chaps who was qualified in all directions, engineering and all the rest of it. You might remember that there was the flying boat Meyer with the Mercury seaplane on the top. He flew the seaplane. And to do astro-navigation, which was not an easy thing then, He used what's called a Bygrave slide rule, one of these tubular slide rules, to do his calculations. But a remarkable chap, no doubt about it. And he managed even to change the layout of the navigator's log, which was one of these sacred cows, you know. And of course, once you got G, and then other things came along where you could pinpoint instantaneously, get instant. Not really a pinpoint, but an instantaneous fix with G, whereas with if you use a radio loop, you get one line and then you get another, and you have to allow for the time that's elapsed because the aircraft's running on to try and use that. With the G, you've got an instantaneous fix. So he worked on the basis. Whereas with pinpointing, but map reading, you can only pinpoint when you see something. You can pinpoint. With this system, you could say, right, every 6 minutes, I'm going to take a G fix, multiply it by 10, and you've got a ground speed. So he was really thought all this sort of thing out. And another chap who's very versatile, Ron Hockey. Doesn't say much about him, he's a modest fellow, but he's I come back to him. It was at that stage, I was phoned up by 3 group nav officer, asked whether I'd like to go to Thamesford. I had visited Thamesford, so I had some, and of course this previous occasion going back to Stradishall, when we had met the flight, which had now become a squadron, 138 squadron. And then another squadron was formed out of that, 161, which was made up of Group Captain Fielden's King's Flight. Well, with the Hudson, the King's Hudson was stripped and used for our pickup operations in France, and Lysanders, and they had a small group of Whitleys. And there were Whitleys in 138, later replaced by Halifaxes.
So you went to 138 Squadron, did you?
No, I went to the station. I was on the station headquarters. But that's where I'm involved with the station commander, Group Captain Fielden, as was for a long time. We later had a Wing Commander Operations, John Corby. And at that time, through the Group Captain, we sort of did our own thing. We had 2 people to work for, really, SOE and SIS. And they would come through. We had a huge map in the intelligence room, a secret map with all the points where these resistance groups were. And they would say what operation, where people would be dropped, all supplies dropped, and so on, and where pickups were required. And then we would decide, looking at the weather and what our resources were, what could be done. That was the group captain, Fielden, then at that time decided that. Later the thing expanded. They put a couple of wing commanders in the Bomber Command headquarters. And then we were later still put into 38 group, the transport group. And some of their people came on our sort of work. And we did have, as we were getting closer to the to the invasion, and thereafter the flights like Stirling people were brought in, seconded to us. Stirling was not a very successful bomber, but it was quite all right for our sort of work. So that's how that developed. Well, then I flew a couple of times with Group Captain Fielden, but he would, of course, whenever the King was flying anywhere with a very excellent transport command crew, he would go off to supervise the flight side. That was his function. I asked to fly with people, getting where one could to get the experience. And I flew with Sir Alan Boxer. He was commanding a flight in 138, which included some Poles. We had some Poles with us who were naturally primarily flew to Poland, but did fly elsewhere. Very good chaps, very eager. They finally went out to North Africa in order to fly up into Poland. Remember the Warsaw